Last night at midnight, the Trump administration began the process of reimposing economic sanctions against Iran. These are sanctions that have been lifted by the Obama administration as part of the Iran nuclear deal. But after withdrawing from that deal, the Trump administration is making good on its pledge to punish Iran by cutting it off from the region and the world. As the Trump administration edges ever closer to an all but stated potential goal of regime change in Iran. To help us make sense of the sanctions, their significance and impact, we're joined today by Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council. Mr. Abdi joins us from Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Let's start at the beginning. What are the sanctions that were just imposed last night?
So the sanctions that were imposed, this is the first tranche of nuclear-related sanctions that were lifted under the Iran nuclear agreement. So this includes sanctions on the automotive sector, sanctions on gold going to Iran, sanctions on dollars going to Iran. And so the other thing that it includes is aircraft parts and the sale of aircraft. So sort of confidence-building measure in the Iran deal was that Boeing was actually going to be able to sell planes to Iran. And the sanctions on Iran obtaining civilian aircraft have really wreaked havoc inside of Iran. Iran has one of the poorest civilian aircraft safety records because they fly these planes that are really outdated, and sanctions for decades now have prevented the provision of spare parts, have prevented Iran from buying these new planes. And so part of the Iran deal, the idea was, you know, we're going to allow for these to be sold to Iran. This is not just, you know, good for the deal, but it's good for the Iranian people. It shows that the U.S. is aware of these sort of concerns and humanitarian issues. And a big part of it was this is going to be the first incidents of a U.S. company, a major U.S. company in Boeing, actually doing business with Iran and potentially being the opening of greater economic exchange between the two countries down the road. So that's all off the table now. And this first tranche has gone into effect. The second sort of basket of sanctions will go into effect in November. And those are the really big ones. Those are the oil sanctions.
So this first set that's now been imposed in the lead up to the imposition, because it's been several months now that the Trump administration has said that these sanctions would be reimposed, companies had already started pulling out of Iran or, as you say, canceling projects that were planned. So what is the state of the Iranian economy right now, and how much worse do you think it's going to get even before the oil sanctions get imposed?
The economy is in a very bad way. Now, even under the nuclear deal, Iran's economy did not rebound as many Iranians had expected, what they felt they had been promised. And so this is a economy that was already limping along under sanctions. Iran brokered the nuclear deal, expected to have the sanctions lifted, and even, you know, the Iran deal did not lift the U.S. trade embargo on Iran. It did not lift the restriction against U.S. banks clearing dollars for transactions involving Iran or for direct relationships between U.S. banks and Iranian banks. And so, really, it was very difficult to actually effectuate sanctions relief because of all the restrictions that remained in place, even under the nuclear deal. To address this, the Obama administration, some will remember, went on these roadshows after the nuclear deal to explain to foreign companies, to foreign countries, to foreign bankers that Iran was now open for business And that the United States was not going to sanction them for investing in Iran, going in Iran, doing business with Iran. And this was intended to reverse sort of the years of, broadening U.S. sanctions and really tough enforcement by the United States. So John Kerry, Jack Lew, other Obama administration officials went around to try to convince these companies and these banks, to allow the sanctions relief to go forward. As soon as Trump took office, that all reversed, and you had the opposite message coming forward, even under the nuclear deal. But essentially, President Trump insinuating he was imminently about to tear up the deal, warning other countries not to do business with Iran. These are things that the Iranians said actually were a violation of the nuclear deal, because the U.S. was supposed to not interfere with the normalization of trade with the country. The point being, Iran's economy never really emerged from the crippling sanctions that had been put in place under the Obama administration and over the preceding sort of decade. Post-nuclear deal being, at least ripped up on the United States' side, Iran's economy has really suffered, and the major driver for that has been inflation. The Iranian rial has lost, I think, the value compared to the dollar has shot up to, 100,000 rial to the dollar. And it was at, I think, 40,000 at the beginning of the year. So that has hit Iranians very hard. And this is in the midst of these ongoing economic struggles. And so you kind of do have a perfect storm of bad economic signs for the Iranian economy, and that's where you start to see, there's been these demonstrations, people are very fed up, and a lot of that is due to this economic situation.
So, like, the demonstrations, who do they target? Like, how do the sanctions impact the balance of power in Iranian politics?
Yeah, the demonstrations, the first demonstrations that we really saw of this larger magnitude started at the end of December, and we've seen them sort of sporadically crop up. These were much different than the demonstrations that we had previously seen in Iran that were centered in Tehran, and that were in 2009 after the Iranian presidential election, where Ahmadinejad won, and many people disputed those results, you had the Green Movement. You had these mass demonstrations, millions of people in the streets. That was Tehran, almost a sort of more cosmopolitan, more, people who wanted engagement with the West and wanted moderation and very, sort of civically and politically motivated. The demonstrations that we have seen now over the past, several months that began in December have actually been much more diffuse. They've been all around Iran, less centered on the big, population centers, less, we haven't seen many of these in Tehran. And these are largely, they start as protests against the economic situation, strikes by truck drivers and bazaar merchants and things like that. But the initial spark for the first protests were actually, it was a result of Iran's president, Rouhani, leaking the budget and showing how much of Iran's budget actually goes to these government-linked entities, sort of controlled by harder-line elements within the government that Rouhani has tried to sort of go up against, and which his whole platform of moderation and engagement with the West and privatization is really a threat to those entities. And so by leaking those, it was supposed to be, supposed to undercut them. What the conservatives in Iran's government did was they actually tried to organize against that, and that's where the protests started, with some of the very conservative leaders calling on Iranians to take to the streets to protest the Rouhani government. And so you actually had this is sort of an internecine battle between elements within the government and sort of mobilizing people to fight those battles. I think what the sanctions do is it really undercuts Rouhani's government, and it really undercuts this notion that engagement with the West and changing Iran's policies, moving away from the Ahmadinejad approach, which was, you know, resistance and, you know, fighting power with power, standing up to the United States, it really undercuts what Rouhani put forward, which was that we need to negotiate and we need to actually find compromise. The message now is, you know, what the Supreme Leader is saying is, I told you so, I told you the United States couldn't be trusted, and essentially saying that this idea has failed. What you've seen in Iran is that Rouhani has sort of moved to the right as a result, and I think that there's been a sort of a coalescing of agreement between the different factions to a degree, unifying against the United States and taking a little bit of a harder line and maybe eschewing to a degree some of that language of moderation and attempts to actually build bridges with the United States.
Where do you see this moving, particularly because the next set of sanctions, the oil sanctions, are obviously potentially the most crippling, cutting off Iran from its largest source of GDP, oil, and of course natural gas as well, and also a potential future of earning money from oil and natural gas. Do you see a hardening of positions in Iran, meeting a hardening of positions in the United States with leadership from people like Bolton, who have been very clear that regime change was at least his personal goal, and it was certainly a goal of the Bush administration, of which he came out of?
I think it's going to be very difficult for Iran to respond to this and to deal with this, but this is also a country and a government that has weathered many crises, weathered the crippling sanctions of the Obama era, the sanctions imposed by the Bush administration, and sort of some of the regime change efforts, a country that went through an 8-year war with Iraq and that involved chemical weapons. And so, you know, I do think that things look bad for the Iranian economy, and I think these demonstrations are something that we haven't necessarily seen, this phenomenon, under the Islamic Republic at least. That being said, I do think that there are many ways that, at least economically, they can weather this. I think that you're going to see Iran, much like they did under the crippling sanctions of Obama, become very close with China and Russia, even India, who had pledged to actually comply with the oil reduction sanctions. We've seen they're actually ramping up their imports of Iranian oil. And so, you know, I think...
Sorry, could they be ramping up their imports now in advance of the implementation of sanctions in November?
Yeah, so I think so the way that those sanctions work is that as long as countries are demonstrating that they're reducing their imports, they're supposed to get a waiver from the United States. And initially, the Trump administration said they would not be doing that, that these countries needed to go to zero at November. And then since then, they've backed off a little bit. They've suggested maybe there are exceptions. They actually, I think, made a deal with China, where they said that they would grant exceptions as long as they were reducing. And so what I think India is doing, and others may do, is ramp up ahead of November so that as they set that as the level, and then they can decrease from that level, but it's not as drastic a loss as it otherwise would be.
I feel like I need a 101 level primer on how sanctions work. Like, how does the United States get to tell China how much Iranian oil it can import? What's its leverage?
So this is all based on the United States's central role in the global financial system. So essentially what the United States says is, if you do business with Iran, if your company or your bank does business with Iran, you're going to be locked out of the United States. And even if you don't do business, you know, inside the United States, you are likely having to touch, you know, go through the U.S. financial system at some point to, you know, clear dollars and other things like that. So it's very difficult for a company or a bank to not comply with these sanctions unless they don't do business with the U.S. And that's actually why China has been able to evade, but hasn't been as compliant with these sanctions in the past, because they actually have banks that are set up to to only do business with Iran and other countries that don't go through the United States at all. And so as much as they are, you know, sort of not integrated with the U.S.-run global financial system, they are able to continue doing this business with Iran because it's the U.S. does not have that leverage.
So the Trump administration is obviously pitting itself quite solidly against China, but has sought better relations with Russia. And do you think that potentially one of the things that President Trump is discussing with Vladimir Putin is for Russia to, at a minimum, stay on the sidelines in a confrontation between the United States and Iran, or more likely play ball on the U.S. side when it comes to doing things like imposing sanctions, trying to shut down Iran's oil market, et cetera?
I think that, the first thing is that what Trump is doing actually does really benefit Russia. Russia will be one of the countries that benefits from higher oil prices, from less oil in the Iranian market. And so that actually economically probably makes sense for Russia. It also makes Iran a lot more dependent on Russia, as well as China. I don't think this is necessarily a bad deal for Putin. Now, I think it's interesting, at the infamous summit with Putin, one of the areas where Trump was still pretty strident was on his Iran position. He was not, sort of towing the line on that. He was still very much, talking about cracking down on Iran and being tough on Iran. So I'm not sure what the discussion was on Iran. It's complicated. Putin is kind of juggling many different interests, especially in Syria. And Putin has sort of turned a blind eye to some of the things that Israel is doing inside of Syria to counter Iran. He's almost, his position is sort of, everybody can kind of get along in there, and he's not going to allow any one side to get too powerful. But as far as long term, if this comes to military action or something like that, I don't know if those discussions have been had yet, but I do think that Russia probably will draw a red line against something like that.
Where do you, you said that you have a good deal of faith in the resilience of the Iranian people. Is there, a strong homegrown Iranian peace movement that is pushing back on increased conservatism rising within the Rouhani government?
I think that constituency has also been very weakened by what has happened with this deal. So Rouhani came in and really staked his political fortunes on getting this deal involving the United States. The plan was, vote for me. We're going to get this deal. The economy is going to benefit. I'm going to have the political capital to actually take on some of the entrenched powers in Iran on some of the social issues and things like that. And, Rouhani is somebody who kind of modulates between the conservatives and the reformers, the folks who want, social changes and things like that inside of Iran. And that was the notion, that he was going to actually be able to go more towards the reformers once he had that political capital. Now the rug has been pulled out from under him. And I think there's a lot of disillusionment inside of Iran among the people who were the ardent Rouhani supporters. So the movement that I think you're referring to is very much, the movement that we saw in 2009 that, protested the election results, the movement that actually helped propel Rouhani to shock a lot of people by winning in 2013. And I really think that movement has been sidelined by a lot of this. And that is evidenced in part by the fact that the protests that we're now seeing are being driven by completely different actors. It's not necessarily organized. A lot of it is spontaneous. As I said, it's very diffuse. So I don't think there's an organized movement behind that. And I think that creates a lot of uncertainty as to, what do the Iranian people want? Where are they driving? Some people are very fearful that it almost seems like 1979, where you had people clamoring for change, but not necessarily, I mean, back in 79, it was actually very well organized, but clamoring for change and not necessarily having an end state in mind. And so if Trump succeeds and destabilizes the government or collapses the economy and you actually have this vacuum, the most powerful and best organized, you know, people in Iran are really the security apparatus, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard. And so I think there's a fear that they would actually fill any vacuum that was created if the Trump-Bolton policy actually achieves this objective.
So for our listeners who I know certainly want to do what they can to stop that type of head-on collision between an excessively conservative U.S. government and a powerful security state, excessively conservative Iranian government, you know, what should listeners be doing about the movement of these sanctions, the direction that the Trump administration is going? Should they be contacting members of Congress? If they should, what should they be asking for? You know, what can listeners do?
Yeah. We are now imposing collective punishment on the Iranian people in our names. And so we're going to start to see the humanitarian impacts of that. So I think it is imperative that those who, you know, do not want war, but also don't believe we should be imposing collective punishment on an entire country's population, to contact Congress. Congress has been silent on this. There are a lot of issues they're juggling, but they have not prioritized this. And we are on a path to war. So we need lawmakers to actually be stepping up and challenging Trump on this, holding hearings, and hopefully in the next Congress actually go in with some degree of a mandate to stop this train towards a military confrontation.
All right. Get in the way of the train. Get on the peace train, actually, I guess would be the appropriate response. Sorry, I couldn't help it. Thank you so much, Jamal Abdi, president of the National Iranian American Council, joining us today from Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. Take care.